Everybody, or good evening, wherever you are. Let's start with our discussions for today. We have a full agenda, and we'll start with the post-implementation review of IFRS 9. And I think Laura is going to tee this up.
Yes, Laura? Thank you, Hans. Thank you. And hello, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about IFRS 9 with you. My name is Laura, and I'm working on the staff on the PIR, and also on the call with us today is Rihanna, and Rihanna leads on all of our financial instruments projects. So the session today will be split into three parts, being a separate discussion on each of the three questions that we have on slide three of your agenda paper four. Before we discuss question one, I have just a couple of things that we thought it would be helpful to mention. The first is that in this PIR, we are focusing solely on classification and measurements. And then later on this year, separately, the board will consider again when will be the best time to start the PIR of the impairment or ECL requirements. Second thing I have is a reminder that the board does not make changes to a standard as part of the PIR project itself. If the board does decide to consider standard setting based on feedback, that would then become its own separate project, which would be subject to all the usual due process requirements, including an exposure draft. And then the third and the last thing I wanted to touch on is why we're asking these three questions and the type of feedback that we're looking for. So in the PIR, we're essentially assessing, has the standard been successful in achieving the goal of improving financial reporting? And these three questions here are the ones that we think will help the board in making that assessment. So we've got one, are the requirements working as intended? Two, are there any significant unexpected effects? And three, are the requirements capable of being applied consistently? And we think that using these three questions is going to help us in two ways. The first way is that they will provide us with a framework for discussing specific issues. So it's clear exactly why a particular topic is being discussed. And you'll have seen that further back in the slide pack, to help make it clear the type of feedback that the board's looking for, we've included some more detailed questions on specific areas of the requirements. And we've set up those detailed questions by developing them in the context of these three more overarching questions. And then, as well as that, we think that having these three overarching questions also acts as a helpful reminder to step back and to take a more holistic view of the standard. And I think with the exception of some specific issues, what we've generally been hearing so far is that overall IFRS 9 is working well in practice. And for us, it's important to collect that positive feedback and to collect that more general kind of feedback, as well as looking into specific issues, because that means the board will have a full rather than a partial picture of how the requirements are working. So with that, I will hand over to ASAF members, and I'll ask that we start with question one, which is, are the requirements working as intended?
Okay, we open the floor. Jeho, KESB.
Thanks, Hans. I would like to make comments based on the activities of the KESB's IFRS 9 supporting task force. When IFRS 9 was published, the KESB established the IFRS 9 supporting task force, which consists of a wide range of stakeholders in order to help the practice smoothly transition to the new standards. For nearly 2.5 years, from October 2016 to March 2019, the task force discussed more than 40 issues. So based on that, for question one, in general, we think I+9 responded well to the stakeholders' request for more principle-based and less complex standards. First, I+9 is more principle-based in that the classification is based on the business model for managing financial assets and also the contractual cash flows characteristics of financial assets. And I+9 is less complex in that it has only three classification categories as opposed to IS 39 having four classification categories. Having said that, we would like to draw attention to some implementation issues relating to fair value through OCI classification. Some insurance companies argue that it is inconsistent to prohibit the recycling of OCI for fair value through OCI equity instruments, while requiring the recycling of OCI into P&L for fair value through OCI debt instruments. And also the KSB's I+9 supporting task force discussed an issue about whether transaction cost incurred at the disposal of fair value through OCI equity instrument should be recognized in P&L or in OCI. So given these issues, we think it would be worthwhile to examine whether the fair value through OCI classification is working well as intended and provide useful information. Thank you.
Linda.
Thank you. We would say that generally speaking, we think IFRS 9 is working, but I'll add a little color to that. Since 2016, we've had multiple discussions of IFRS 9 with our IFRS discussion group. We started out by trying to raise awareness around the implementation of IFRS 9 and also help smaller entities go through their implementation of IFRS 9 by discussing these issues. I would say about half of the issues were related to SPPI, and so there was quite a bit of need to socialize and get people used to the notion of having to go through that hurdle to classify things basically at book value or at cost. And so there were some very specific issues that were Canadian only in terms of some specific notes that were issued in Canada for capital purposes. But in general, we would see that most of the topics were SPPI. There were a few topics related to modifications or exchanges of financial liabilities. And I can certainly give the staff more detail on those specifics if you're interested, but it's also available on our website. So we would say, generally speaking, it's functioning. The one thing that the feedback we got, which was from the banking industry, this particular feedback, was that we would ask you to consider some of the new lending products. And a specific example they gave us actually has to do with there seems to be an increase of loans issued with interest rate adjustments linked to ESG metrics. So, for instance, the example we got was renewable energy used relative to overall usage. And so there would be a relationship of assessing those and seeing whether or not they qualify for SPPI, because otherwise you're going to get, depending on the judgments made, you're going to get different treatment. It would either be at book or it would be fair value through P&L. So generally speaking, functioning, but I think we need to look at some of the new products just to make sure it will continue to function.
Okay, thank you, Linda. Friedrich?
Thank you, Hans. I will probably echo the comments of my predecessor in a way that based on the feedback from AOSG members, those responded the CNM part of the standard works generally well. However, there is a number of the application issues that entities have been working through. in respect to answer specifically question one, on a positive side, the distinction between fair value through OCI and fair value through P&L is useful information. However, some elections, especially the irrevocable election to classify equity instruments into the fair value through OCI category, doesn't necessarily improve the consistency and comparability. On credit isolation and fair value in OCI for the fair value of the financial liabilities was appreciated as making life easier to users and analysts. Number of the registrants did call out, as Linda just mentioned, the ESG sustainability linked instruments, and that assessment of SPPI is the area of being involved. Just continuing on, I think I will probably highlight at this stage modifications, and I think the debate around the IBOR project, and I think there were some thoughts about the narrow scope amendment to the standard to cater for modification. I think that area remains topical. That's it from me for now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Friedrich. Novo?
Yes, thank you. We are currently in the process of conducting extensive outreach on this project. So today, my comments will be very preliminary ones. And our comments are those that are recurring, and they're not about whether the standards are working as intended, but those relate to those that we were not convinced with when IFRS 9 was initially developed. We have two concerns or two aspects that we were not convinced with, and the first is the non-recycling of the fair value option for equity investments. We continue to believe that recycling is necessary, and even after the adoption of IFRS 9, we continue to believe that recycling would provide better information. The second relates to the fair value measurement of all equity investments, especially those that are unlisted. And we see a lot of cost incurred in obtaining the fair values of them, but the users don't find them necessarily useful. Many have told us that the fair values don't reflect the fact that they're not held for trading. And usually these unlisted entities have restrictions on trading, and therefore a fair value measurement does not necessarily reflect the situation that it is unlisted. So for those, we still have concerns, and I think when we do some extensive outreach, we can add more to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Novo. Chiara?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Very good. Very. So similarly to what Linda, Nobu, and Jeho have said, the biggest issue seems to be the absence of recycling for value through OCI. And you may recall that we issued a feedback statement on the 30th of January 2020 on a survey run on this subject. So we have also a good insight of where this call is coming from. Similarly, also to what has been said, we have been reported the issue of green loans, but also green bonds. So not only the clause related to the interest rate, but also some type of limited recourse to finance projects for the transition to greener economy. Then I have a list of more detailed issues. I may mention some of these, and I'm very happy to share with the staff the details. Loans with so-called administrative rates, that is with the rates other than with benchmark rates, seems that they are becoming more frequent. For example, the interest is based on the actual funding rate of the bank. Another issue which came to our attention during the IBOR project was the mismatch due to different timing of reset of the rates. In particularly, when due to the IBOR reform, there is a reset to previous to the last reset rate. On the business model, we have heard that in periods of stress, there have been issues with the reclassification requirements that were a bit too high and ardor for entities, in particular for banks, and also an application issue during the period of stress. It was unclear whether the sales were permitted or not. Diversity in practice on contractually linked instrument and how the look-through approach is to be applied. What also has been mentioned previously is the lack of guidance for modification cash flows. And I think these are the main points, but I'm happy to share the details with the staff.
Okay, thank you, Chiara. You.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Hans. Currently, we only have a limited feedback regarding the implementation of the PIR IFRS 9. Our financial instrument team just proposed some general and preliminary comments. On question one, we generally think that IFRS 9 is working as intended. We think that the provisions on classification and the measurement of financial assets in IFRS 9 are more concise and logical, and the provisions on the reclassification of financial assets are also clearer, which improves the objectivity of the classification of financial instrument and ensure the consistency between the accounting treatment and the substance of the transactions. Another point, we think that the financial statements and notes prepared in accordance with IFRS 9 generally can provide investors with useful information. Take the change of on credit as an example. The change of on credit in the fair value of financial liability included in OCI, this treatment not only makes liabilities carrying amount closer to their true value, but also provides investors with more useful information for decision making. Yeah, that's it. That's our preliminary comments on question one. Thank you.
Thank you, Yu. Patrick.
Thank you, Hans. on classification and measurement, we have a rather extensive list of questions that we will share with the staff. I'm going to highlight the key points. On the SPPI criterion and for the assessment of the criterion, it's generally working, but there are points. Chiara mentioned one, which have to be considered. The first one would be sustainability linked or ESG indexed financial instruments, for which the development of those instruments is creating a challenge. And we also would like to flag the contractually linked instruments. The stakeholders say that the application guidance for the look-through approach for assessing whether each tranche meets the SPPI criterion is difficult to understand and therefore to apply. That was for the SPPI criterion. On the business models, stakeholders mentioned that they are running into some difficulties, even if the overall system works. And I would like to mention the bank's liquidity buffer, which might be treated in different ways, while in fact, facts and circumstances are pretty similar. We also would like to flag the reclassification of financial assets in accordance with paragraph 441, which requires an entity to reclassify when and only when the entity changes its business model. in practice, the requirement frees the business model. And therefore, there are difficulties with loan syndications and transfer within a group, for instance. Still on the business model, there are questions about the level at which an entity's business model has to be assessed. I would like also, of course, to concur with the previous comments on the measurement of equity instruments, and mentioning that the recycling issue is a burning issue. But mention also the points related to putable instruments and also disclosures. Finally, there are two points: prohibition to apply IFRS 9 to items that are derecognized at the date of initial application of IFRS. This is something that needs to be reviewed, and also the relationship with those sections of IAS 39 which have been onboarded in IFRS 9, and the related questions. So we will send a detailed comment to the staff.
Thank you, Patrick. Mark.
Thank you. So generally, requirements are considered to work effectively in practice based on the feedback from our stakeholders and also discussions with our banking regulator. We carried out a thematic review of IFRS 9 looking at banks and corporates, and that did not identify any particular issues. In common with a number of the other speakers today, the recycling issue has been raised by a number of stakeholders with the view that that needs to be considered again and resolved. In common with some other speakers, concerns about, well, issues to consider in the PIR, ESG lending and failing the SPPI test. On slide 24 of the presentation, there's a difference in the wording for modifications to contractual cash flows for assets and liabilities, which is causing some practical issues for users, and also contractually linked instruments have had a number of practical implementation issues, including unavailability of necessary data and historic documentation. And whether issuers have been able to fill that data gap is one thing that would be helpful to consider. And then other comment is really for those outside of financial services. Many have observed that the standard is complex in terms of logical flow and drafting of individual sections. I think two sort of broad caveats is obviously we've yet to see how the insurance sector is responding, and also our evidence is based on a very unusual reporting period that's been affected by the pandemic, which sort of limits perhaps the how representative the evidence is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Leonardo.
Yes, thank you. I will repeat some of the comments already made by other ESAF members. The first one is on the SPPI test, because some preparers said more guidance is needed on how to apply the standard to non-recourse loans and new financial instruments such as green bonds and green loans. Another issue that was already mentioned is accounting for equity instrument, because many do not agree with the prohibition of recycling gain and losses recognized in OCI into P&L. And the last point that I want to mention is on the distinction of business models. Also in this case, a preparer told us that more guidance on how to differentiate between the auto-collect business model and the auto-collect and sell business model would be useful, especially to assess the requirement on frequent and significant sales. For the moment, these are our comments. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Leonardo. Laura?
Thank you. Okay. So maybe I'll ask if we go to question two, which is the question around, have you seen any unexpected effects that were significant, whether that be either positive or negative?
Okay, we open the floor again. I have a feeling that probably most people feel that they have answered this question in their first contribution. But
yes,
if there are any specific contributions to be made, then that can happen now. So I see there is no, oh, Sue, yes.
Thanks, Hans. Thanks for all of the comments. That's a really interesting overview of some of the things that you're focusing on. And I don't think any of you said much that surprised me relative to what I would have expected. I know that today you're just giving us an overview of your initial thinking in its early days, but ultimately what's really going to be helpful for us is if you can help work with us to give us as many specifics as possible. So if I can use the example of the sustainability linked instruments, which is very topical. I know I hear about it a lot when I'm talking to people. The more we can understand about the types of instruments so that we can think about the issues and also sort of thinking about it in two ways. One is issues that make it more or less difficult to apply the requirements and the standards. So how much is it about whether the requirements that we wrote clearly not predicting these sustainability linked instruments are actually operable, sufficiently clear, et cetera. So whether or not people understand what to do. And then separately, the question of whether the information is useful or not, depending on whether instruments meet the SPPI criteria or not. Those sorts of specifics will be really helpful for us when we're thinking through how to look at these issues on this PIR. But thank you for the initial comments. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and let me add to that that I think we should also, in terms of the question about equity instruments and fair value through OCI, I think we should also look in detailed way as to how that has played out in the United States, where it was completely abolished, and what have the effects been in practice? Is there still a big yearning for the return of fair value through OCI in the United States? Sometimes I fear that we made a bit of a mistake by keeping it the issue alive by creating this separate category. So I'm really curious how that plays out in the United States. Perhaps you can tell us just a little bit.
Yeah, just some initial reactions. I think we are getting, you know, we abolished it entirely, including for strategic investments and fair value net income. We are getting in our PIR feedback some concerns about whether or not fair value net income makes the most sense for strategic or long-held investments, and a question of whether we would return to OCI with recycling, and including, you know, one of our most prominent U.S. investors who also happens to be a preparer, challenging whether fair value through net income works for some of his investments. We've got some press on, won't name him on the call, but think of well-known investor in the U.S.
All right, thank you. Friedrich.
Thank Hans. One area where I was thinking about how to answer question two was the feedback from a couple of stakeholders that the staged approach to IFRS 9 obviously understood why the board took that, made the transition requirements and their implementation obviously more complex compared to the other standards. So obviously if there is possibility to avoid that staged approach in the future, I think that was the suggestion from the stakeholders, but obviously they understand why it was done the way it was.
Okay, thank you. Patrick?
I just wanted to to thank Jim for his comment. I want to highlight that this, in terms of unexpected effects, it's always difficult to measure an unexpected effect because it might be a long-term issue. But it is perceived in the EU, the recycling issue, as being a very, very important point to cover. And probably not, Hans, if I may say so, by moving back to fair value through P&L. So, because that would create volatility, that would create difficulties. And, you know, if the you know, the framework is the mixed model between, you know, with fair value and historical cost, you need to stick to it, in my view. But go till the end, i.e. when there is a capital gain being realized, to have it in the P&L in due course. But that is linked also to the ambiguous nature, which we will probably never solve, of OCI. But if we stick to the framework, it makes huge sense to recycle and, by the way, to introduce an appropriate impairment.
Yeah. Well,
maybe just to put my earlier comment.
Equity is volatile. Everybody investing in equity knows it is volatile. Investors understand that too, and I don't think it should be all that difficult to explain to investors. Sorry, Jim, you wanted to get back in?
Just to put my earlier comments in context, we used to have a free choice for all equity investments, yeah, unless it was designated as trading. And so I think there was some very positive feedback of limiting that. I think it's just some class that some would like a strategic investment. So I think they viewed as an improvement, but there are some larger, longer held investments that some feel should be given that choice. One of our investor trade groups actually rebutted that. So there's mixed feedback. I don't want people to walk away thinking that it's sort of a unanimous view in the US.
Okay. All right. So Laura, do we want to continue with the third question?
Maybe. So our third question is, are the requirements capable of being applied consistently? I think perhaps like question two, I know some of you have touched on this already, for example, with the feedback on contractually linked instruments. So maybe just to check if there were any other specific comments.
Linda.
Thank you. And we do have specific examples, which I will pass along to the staff, or I'll ask our staff to. But specifically, we asked the question is, are you noticing where you can assess something and you come up with different interpretations or different answers? And there were a couple of areas that were highlighted, and we have actually very specific examples. One relates to the SPPI guidance on non-recourse instruments. And so we have an example where there's a non-recourse loan collateralized by auto lease agreements. And depending on your interpretation, you could either conclude it's SPPI eligible or not. So that was one example. Another one has to do with modification of financial assets came up several times around whether you would conclude that you either had a modification or derecognition. And again, we will supply you with those very specific examples. And the other one had to do with the definition of own credit risk in terms of how much OCI you might recognize. And depending on your interpretation, depending on the swap curve you use, you could come up with very different answers in terms of the quantification. So we will pass all of these examples along, the details of all of these examples along by email.
Friedrich? Oh, sorry, I skipped Chiara. Chiara, please.
Yes, thank you. On diversity practice for the business model, we heard that the requirement to assess frequent and significant sales is given rise to diversity. In addition to the modification that was also mentioned by Linda.
Okay, Friedrich?
I have a list of particular comments that I will share with staff after the session. Just to highlight a few specific examples, I think the loan in amount in excess of original hold for syndicated loans, I think some constituents were raising it as a not necessarily resulting in an intuitive outcome, and things like bail-in clauses, whether they are in terms and conditions or whether they are in regulations, and for example, cases where terms and conditions are referring to the regulations, whether the different outcomes of that assessment under SPPI result in the outcome was flagged. A few other things on modified time and value of money, but I will share those over the email, not to spend time here. Thank you.
Jeho.
Thank you, Hans. We have a bunch of some tricky implementation issues relating to SPPI test. One thing I would like to highlight is about debt instruments that can be prepaid by the issuer before maturity. Currently, both paragraph B4.1.11 and paragraph B4.1.12 of I+9 provide guidance on those specific contractual terms, but we heard that there is a confusion in practice about the relationship between those two paragraphs. Thank you.
Any other comments? Doesn't seem to be the case. Laura, does that mean we have come to the end of this session, or are there other issues you would like to raise?
No, that's all we had, and I think that's given us a helpful base to go on over the coming months with getting into more of the detail on those topics. That's very helpful. We'll look forward to the detailed information.
Good. Thank you, Laura. So shall we take a brief break, 15 minutes, and then come back for the PIR of 10, 11, and 12? Yes? Okay, thank you. So until, let's say, 5 to 12, our time. Okay, thank you.